So look at this, like, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you're at a normal three-course dinner, like how everyone was eating. And this is the end of the conversation. How was your meat? Oh, yeah, yeah, mine was good too. And that's about it, right? Like now, if you're serving the food in the middle and like you take a bite of this and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so spicy. Like, try this. You like spicy, right? And then they're like, oh, this mac and cheese is delicious. Like, it's so creamy. But like, compare it to what the one with truffle here. And yeah, so it just like creates like a nonstop conversation that just goes on and throughout the experience, like, and people are sharing and trying and educating themselves doing it. It's this pretty cool way of eating.
Thanks for joining me. Legends and Losers is sponsored by our friends at Oracle NetSuite. To turbocharge the growth of your business, check out netsuite.com/legends today. Now on this episode, what do you do when your dreams get crushed? This is an awesome story of business and life success with none other than Alex Holt. He's the founder and CEO of a restaurant called Flights. He's a former pro hockey player who was drafted by none other than the San Jose Sharks, who got injured and then couldn't play professionally. He then decided that he would become a restaurateur, and he opened his first restaurant, and he gained a huge insight that led to a massive niche down, which led to him starting this incredible chain called Flights, which is now on fire. So we unpack all of that and a fascinating life story, and Alex also tells us how he convinced Miss Nevada to marry him.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right. Hey ho, let's go. Hello, my legendary friends. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Legends and Losers. I love this conversation. I've been dying to share it with you ever since I had it with Alex. I will forever be fascinated by what people do when they are at what my friend Dr. James Kelly calls a crucible moment. And in this case, one dream dies and he creates a whole other dream and is now having incredible success with a new niche of restaurants called Flight. I also want to thank my dear friend Christine Merritt for connecting me to Alex, this spectacular entrepreneur. So thank you so much, Christine. And I also want to say a big shout out to the entire marketing team at NetSuite. And especially a big thank you to Jason Maynard and Lane Sobel at NetSuite. A few weeks back, they invited me to their event in San Francisco, Suite Connect, and I got to do a book signing there. And I'll tell you, as an author, there's nothing more mind-blowing than a group of people, lining up to talk to you and take selfies with you and so forth. And so I especially want to say thank you if you're one of the folks who came out to see me at Suite World, at Suite Connect. I can never thank you enough. It always blows me away that people want to meet me, get me to sign their books, and I was super stoked to do that. So thank you, everybody at NetSuite, and especially if you're one of the folks that came out, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. All right, now you can learn more about Alex and his background as he went from a Swedish hockey player to a California restaurateur and his contact information. And if you want how to book a reservation at Flight's restaurant, at our show notes at legendsandlosers.com. So without any further ado, here he is, the amazing Alex Holt.
I was drafted by the Sharks 2003, and then I actually was injured that summer right after I got drafted. So my hockey career kind of took a quick turn for the worse. I was playing with the Swedish national team in Russia. Basically my knee and the Russian guy went to the right and I went to the left. So it was one of those kind of not so fun moments, and kind of took my career to a pretty severe halt, and took about a year and a half until I was really back on the ice performing again. And by then I wasn't fast and strong enough anymore. So it kind of winded down my career in Europe, traveling and having fun. And then I kind of switched gears and changed careers.
So did Putin hack your knee?
Yeah, basically it's bullshit.
And so, look, it's very clear that you were having an incredible hockey career. I mean, you were playing for your national team. You had a lot of success early, did you not?
Yeah, I was ranked number two in the country growing up in Sweden. And yeah, I was one of the youngest players ever to play in the Swedish Elite League. And I had a very bright career ahead of me. And then obviously things changed. So.
And so how old were you when you blew your knee up?
19.
And how old were you when you realized, you know, maybe you weren't going to come back from this injury, or did you know right away, or how did that play out?
No, I didn't quite know right away. I kind of was back on the ice only like a month afterwards. And I learned that later when I actually talked to the Sharks knee doctor that the injury that my knee had is a 6 to 9 month process to rehabilitate. And I was back on the ice in the playoffs basically 3-4 weeks after. So it was a pretty big mistake, and my knee never really recovered from that. And I kept re-injuring it. So that's kind of what happened.
So what's that like as a young man who's, I mean, you tell me, I've never been an elite athlete. But I got to believe at that point in your life, hockey has been a gigantic part of what you've dedicated yourself to. Yes.
Yeah, pretty much since I was like 3 years old, every day was about getting faster, stronger and better. And that was all I wanted to do. I was very determined at a very young age. My mom always told me stories like how, like, when normal kids were out like playing, I would be like focusing on my shot and like working on my speed and things like that to get better. I was very, very focused on being an NHL player.
And I'm going to be curious, is Mats Naslund a hero of yours or somebody that you looked up to?
I have to ask why you would bring up Mats Naslund, because I actually had him as a coach in a hockey camp when I was younger. And he's like, I wouldn't consider him like one of the top players from Sweden, but he's definitely very good. It's just interesting what you would ask about him.
Well, I was born and raised in Montreal, Canada.
Ah, that makes sense. That explains it all.
I don't know if he was a big deal in Sweden, but he was a big deal in Montreal for quite a few years. I mean, he was a very serious, no joke hero.
Yeah, no, he was great. He was a really good player. But in Sweden, he kind of ended up in the shade behind and Forsberg and Sundin and those guys. There were so many good Swedish superstars at the time that even though he scored a lot of goals and was a really good forward, he was kind of always, he never kind of lived up to the hype the other stars did.
That's so funny, because I, not being Swedish, I wouldn't have known that. I would have, because he was a big hero and a big part of a bunch of great Canadians teams as I was growing up. So I wouldn't have guessed that, but that's interesting. But he coached you.
Yeah, well, I was at a hockey camp when I was like 10, 11, 12, something like that. And he was one of the like secret superheroes or whatever they called it. And he was on the ice with us. And yeah, he was a very, very nice person and giving back to the community of hockey, which is awesome.
Very cool. And so what's it like to be a very young man to have dedicated a huge percentage of your life since you were three to this one pursuit? And then, you know, on that day where you discover you're not actually going to make it to the NHL, you're not going to play for the San Jose Sharks.
Well, so basically the way it all happened, it kind of wasn't like a from one day to the other. It was more like a transition from basically thinking it was going to happen to, well, it doesn't look like it's happening anymore, to, yeah, it's definitely not happening anymore, till, okay, I should probably do something else.
And that progression doesn't make one happier in life, does it?
No, it was kind of a rough couple of years. It was very frustrating, a lot of, you know, sad moments when I like really felt like I wasn't able to get out what I had inside me, because my body couldn't keep up with, you know, my mind was still thinking as fast and everything else was going as fast, but my body could just not handle the speed that I wanted to go in.
Yeah. And did you find you were slower than the other guys too?
Yeah, definitely lost some of the that first initial kick when you're going into corner, especially the battles, like the corner battles. I never really thought of it myself, but my dad pointed it out to me like afterwards, that, and he showed me some videos of basically me going into like situations where normally I would just go out like all out and guys would not have a chance. And now I would kind of turn my strong side, protect my right knee and kind of like, you know, go in soft in the situations and ended up obviously losing a lot of them.
And you tell me, I mean, I did of course some homework on you and, you know, you're a bigger guy. And so as a bigger guy, speed matters a lot because the smaller guys, of course, are typically going to be a little bit faster. And so if you're giving up a little bit of speed because of that knee as a bigger guy, was that the primary problem that you were noticing or what was it you were noticing?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. The speed and then also the basically like being able to go in 100% in the situations and just like knock other guys down and like take the puck from them versus now I would be like kind of trying to control the situation, protect my knee, actually subconsciously. It wasn't even something that I recognized me and myself doing. It just kind of happened. And like I pointed out, my dad was showing it to me and that's when I was like, oh yeah, maybe you're right.
And of course, guys who play hockey are generally very sweet as it relates to their competitors. And so nobody would ever consider sort of, you know, jamming you hard on the knee or anything, would they?
No, not at all. Yeah.
It's like I'm a huge fight fan and there is no fighter who ever will declare any kind of injury before the fight, right? Because if they know that you got a broken rib or God forbid, or a broken foot or whatever it is, right? It's like, we're going to go in there, we're going to stomp that broken foot or we're going to pound that broken rib, right? And hockey in a lot of ways is like, it's sort of like if soccer was awesome and had fighting.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm not a
fan. Imagine what would happen.
I'm not imagine a huge what soccer fan.
No, but imagine what would happen to Neymar, that Brazilian guy, like if there was actual fighting, he would look like he was completely dead, you know?
I think soccer would be way more entertaining if it was full contact and had fighting and it was just like hockey.
Yeah, I agree. That would be pretty crazy, actually. I'm kind of envisioning this right now, and I think this is the new thing. We should try and make this happen.
We should start a new sports league, given now that you're this incredibly successful entrepreneur. So your career
ends. That would
be
fun.
Your career ends, and then you how do you go from Sweden to, you know, the natural progression of Las Vegas?
So I had started kind of when I noticed that my hockey career wasn't going the direction I wanted it to. I started playing a lot of poker on the internet, more like a hobby than anything, and started to do really well. And when I kind of made the decision to stop pursuing hockey, I thought to myself, okay, I need to do something fun. I need to do something where I'm not going to feel like sad, where it's not going to be like super hard. Cause you know, like you said, hockey has been my everything since I was three. And, so basically I was like, all right, I'm moving to Vegas. So I got like I think it was a 6-month visa. And, I actually bought a condo, right on the strip there in Vegas. And I was like, all right, I'm going. It wasn't my first time in Vegas. I had gone there on vacation quite a few times and I always had a good time. So that's why I was like, okay, I'm going to Vegas. And maybe then basically was, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you know, the thing for me about Vegas, and I've spent a lot of time in Vegas, mostly on business trips. I've been there a few times for non-business things.
Right. But, your wife is listening to this, huh?
No, my wife never listens to the podcast. She could give a shit. And actually, I'm not married to that kind of girl. She's like, she could care less. You know, it's like she either trusts me or she doesn't. So she doesn't have any Vegas fear. But anyway, I noticed this thing, which is on the first night you're in Vegas, there's a whole lot of shit that sort of goes down or somewhere around, you know, 2 to 4 a.m. that, no matter how drunk you are, still kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to you. And then on the second night you're in Vegas, It doesn't make sense, but it's starting to feel a little more natural. And by the third night in Vegas, all the shit going down at 3 a.m. kind of feels exactly like it's supposed to be going down. And so I developed this term called Vegas logic, and that the longer you stay in Vegas, the more shit that would never under normal circumstances make any sense to you starts to make sense. And so long story longer, Alex, by about day four, I got to get the fuck out of there. Otherwise, like, I'm going to end up being a completely different person than the one I am now.
Yeah.
And so you kind of went there to be a different sort of person, did you not?
Yeah, kind of. Well, also, when you live there, it's very different. Like, people that go there on vacation for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, they have a budget. They're going to gamble for this much, you know, buy clothes for this much, go to restaurants for this much, go to clubs for this much. But when you live there, it's more like a normal day-to-day life, except when you do feel like going out, having fun, you have like the best everything out there available to you. So we would kind of live a normal life. Well, not really, I guess, but...
If you call being a retired hockey player aspiring to be a professional poker player a normal life living on the strip, of course.
Yeah, I guess. No, it was kind of crazy. I mean, we had a group, probably 10 to 15 guys. A lot of them played poker. And we would basically do like a normal work day. We woke up, went to the gym, sat in front of computers for like 6, 7 hours, and then went to a nice dinner, and then either went to a club or to a lounge or something. And then some nights was pretty chill and we didn't do too much, and other nights got pretty wild, and we came home at that 4 o'clock in the morning and didn't really know what happened.
As you do. And so how did you do as a pro poker player?
I actually ended up doing pretty well. I was making good money for probably 7, 8 years. And then I ended up meeting a girl in Vegas, which is now my wife, Sarah. And she was Miss Nevada at the time. So that was kind of like a little bit surreal, because everywhere we went, there was like red carpets and billboards with her face hanging down the Palms Casino and nightclub appearances and things like that. And it was very surreal. Like, I remember one of the parties at Surrender at the Wynn. I basically came a little late because I was in some poker game, and I come up to like give her a hug, and I just get this like Australian guy like shove me like really hard in my chest that almost lost my air. And I was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm not a very aggressive guy, like off the ice. So like normal people probably start a fight, but I would just like, excuse me, like, why did you do that? So apparently she was wearing like $7 million worth of jewelry representing this diamond company. So he was the like basically person making sure that no one was like taking it off her body. And then she had to like step in and explain that, you know, we were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time. And it was kind of a crazy night. So basically like meeting her, and we got engaged pretty quick after like 4 or 5 months of dating. And we both kind of decided pretty fast that we need to get out of Vegas. And she's from Silicon Valley. She grew up here. And I kind of wanted to stay in the United States because this is where you can kind of fulfill your dreams and build a big business and make things happen for yourself, which I think is awesome. So basically we moved back here 2012, after like a year and a half in Vegas, and we've been here since then.
So very cool. So this may be a totally inappropriate question, and feel free to kick me under the table, but you know, as one guy to another, you sort of, I gotta ask, like, she was Miss Nevada at the time you met her?
Yes.
Okay. So, and look, I don't know shit about being Miss Nevada, but I would guess, you tell me, when you're Miss Nevada, you probably get hit on a lot.
Yeah, that's why we had to get out of there.
Well, no, so I got to understand, you know, you sort of think about, dating and mating and mate selection and all the stuff that goes on and this and that and the other. And so when you're Miss Nevada, there's all these dudes, right? And so right. But you were the dude that sort of won the prize, so to speak. So how do you cut through the noise and sort of beat all the other guys to kind of win the princess?
Well, it wasn't easy, I can tell you that. I knew right away, like first time I met her, so she was standing in the lobby of the building that I own a place called Panorama Towers. And Panorama Towers is known for being basically the stripper heaven, like where all the strippers live for some reason. I don't know why, but that's how everyone says.
Again, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to. I got to believe it was just a coinkydink that you bought a place where all the strippers live.
I had no idea that was the case, okay?
All right, I got you. Keep going.
So anyways, so Sarah's standing there with a girl named Erica that I actually knew from before. And it was St. Patrick's Day, and they were dressed like, you know, green funny shirts, ready to go out and drink a green beer. So the condo or the high-rise had a limousine service. So basically, you can get a limousine service within 3 miles complimentary. So they had already booked the limo when I went up to ask for the limo to go meet my friends at Lovo. And basically, I invited myself in the limo. And in the limo ride over, I convinced them to skip the green beer and come to Lovo with me and my friends. And fast forward about 2 hours later, me and Sarah is kind of sliding further and further down the leather couch and talking about very private things. And I end up calling my mom and I'm like, hey, mom, I just really want you to, and it's like 6 a.m. there or something stupid like that. I think it's even 4 a.m. And she's like, hello, what is everything okay, Alex? And I'm like, yeah, I actually met the person I think I'm going to marry and I wanted you to say hi to her. So I pass this off the phone to Sarah and she's like kind of drunk on wine and like, hi, thinking she's never going to meet this woman. and she had no idea what I was saying. And basically, we didn't really talk about this until, I guess, the wedding, when my mom was kind of like telling everyone the story, and it was kind of funny. Yeah, but basically it was, you know, for me, it was love at first sight. I thought a miracle had happened. She was running a Christian school's preschool program. And she was Miss Nevada. And the other girls I was, you know, kind of hanging around at the time was definitely not of that quality. So I was like, wow, this is incredible. And I went home that night and I started deleting a bunch of Facebook pictures and a bunch of things like to clean up my Facebook to make sure that she would like, you know, go through my stuff and make sure that I look legit to actually go on a date with. And
so
then
you didn't look like the kind of guy that a Christian school teacher might want to hang out with if I looked at your Facebook profile at the time there, Alex.
probably not. I think especially the visit to the Playboy Mansion and things like that would not be appreciated. So yeah. I ended up deleting it all and yeah, basically thinking that we were in love and things were going to take off. And like a couple of days went by and she was like not responding. And I was that guy that like kept sending her text messages, and like 1 out of 6 messages, she sent me back a little like, hi, or I'm good, how are you? Kind of like that. And I was like writing like novels to her. So basically like 3 weeks goes by and she's just like really, really not like getting back to me or wanting to talk to me at all. And I had 2 friends, old hockey players, that flew in from Sweden, and we ended up going to Hawaii, Cancun, and Ultra Music Festival in Miami as this was all happening. And I could not get, like, I was like not interested in going out. I didn't want to talk to any girls. It was, yeah, it was just kind of weird. And then finally around Easter, I think the guy she was kind of talking to at the time was like blowing her off. And that's when she started like kind of talking back to me. And then when we both got back to Vegas, we ended up going on our first date at Mandalay Bay. And that's when things changed. And we both kind of got on the same page and fell in love pretty quick.
Wow. So persistence pays off if you want to marry Miss Nevada. Is that what I should take from this, Alex?
Yeah, and showing up in white pants, white shirt, and white leather jacket to her first date, really, really impressed too.
Why were you dressed all in white?
Did
you say white leather pants?
No, leather jacket.
Oh, leather jacket. Okay.
I looked so Euro. I didn't quite realize that at the time. I actually thought I looked great, but this is an ongoing joke in our relationship, and yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's sort of like what were those characters? Dan Aykroyd and shit, who is the other guy? And they were playing those Euro guys on Saturday Night Live, and we're going to go over there and show those foxes our bulges. And remember that whole sketch?
No.
Oh, anyway, it was funny. So you look like a funny European to the average American in Vegas.
I would definitely say so.
So then let's fast forward a little bit. How did you get into the restaurant business?
So basically my mom have opened a bunch of restaurants back in Sweden, 35 years in that business. So in between hockey seasons, both me and my brother would be helping in the bar. We would help in the kitchen. We would help pretty much anywhere we were needed, so to speak. And I always had been pretty interested in cooking. And in the past, I was kind of thinking I wanted to like open a club or a lounge or something like that, because I really liked that scene. But when you get married and you start to kind of go into the next phase of your life, that kind of goes out the door. And
a little less of the
yeah, exactly. So the restaurant business seemed pretty fun. So it really started with my wife saying that I need to get a real job and stop sitting in front of a computer in my underwear. So that's how it really started. So she was
not too sexy.
No, she, I think honestly, it's the Bay Area's traffic's fault, because she was a principal in Palo Alto. We were living in Los Gatos, which is about 20-minute drive, no traffic. And it literally
should be a 20-minute drive, right?
Yeah, it literally takes an hour and 15 minutes at commute time. So basically she would wake up at 6, be out the door by 7 to get to work at 8. And then she would work all day with screaming, you know, little ones, and then sit in that traffic come home at 6, and she was pissed off every time. It was like without fail, she was furious, road rage when she came home. And then I was sitting there in my underwear. What did you do? Oh, you know, I went for a little workout, and then I just been sitting here. It
and
wasn't
so
working.
You were making
very well.
A living playing poker on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there was a
little bit of a resentment of the underwear poker playing.
Yeah, there was. And also they kind of shut down the online market kind of in that time. So basically I ended up like, yeah, I need to get a real job. So I started thinking what I wanted to do, and the restaurant business sounded fun. So we started kind of looking around for a good location and come up with a concept of menu and all these things. And we opened a restaurant called Holtz, which is my last name. And we did that in 2013, and we had that place open for 5 years. And the fourth year, we ended up opening the first Flights restaurant, which is about a year ago now. And it took off like crazy. So basically, with Flights, everything is served three different ways. So drinks, cocktails, beer, wine. And the food, all the different foods, the desserts, the brunch items, everything comes three different ways. So like, for example, if you order a margarita, one is the classic flavor, one is mango jalapeno, one's passion fruit pineapple. So it looks really good. Presentation wise, it's really good. And we give really good value, I think, to our guests. And so basically, since we opened a year ago, it's been full every single day. So we were like, okay, we're on to something with this concept. And we decided to kind of remodel the Holtz location and make that into Flights. And then 2 months ago, we opened a new one in Burlingame on Burlingame Avenue. That's really took off and became super popular right away. And then we're also in construction in Mountain View. And the biggest one is that Planet Hollywood actually called us from Las Vegas, which is funny because we were talking so much about Vegas. So we've got a really, really unbelievable deal with them to go into Planet Hollywood Miracle Miles on the strip there in Vegas. So that's kind of what's happening right now. We're kind of planning that and working on getting that all together for next year.
So the good Lord, if I could say that way, is bringing you back to Vegas, Alex.
Yeah, I guess so.
So I find this, You know, and when Christine told me about you, I remembered you. You, of course, won't remember me, but I walked into Holtz, you know, I wouldn't say a regular, but I was there a handful of times. And at least once, maybe twice, you came over and introduced yourself. And I remember the first time you did it when I left the restaurant, I thought, wow, first of all, you were very, very affable and very friendly and so forth. And you were the right kind of sort of friendly and affable, you know, like with a waiter. You want a friendly waiter, but you don't necessarily want a waiter who becomes part of your meal.
Yeah, that very fine much line, so.
Right? And you seem to have that sixth sense of coming over, introducing yourself as the owner and being very friendly and welcoming and all that, but not sort of like, oh, now I'm going to sit down and be part of your conversation, right? And so I remember the first time I met you walking out thinking, wow, that guy seems really cool and all of that. And so you just seem like the kind of guy who'd be successful. And then it was a great restaurant, of course, but it wasn't really that differentiated, was it?
In what do you mean?
Well, you tell me. My memory of your first restaurant was it was a nice kind of higher, mid-high end kind of a place. Mm-hmm. Not like super high end, but sort of one tier down from super high end, if I could think. You'll tell me how you thought about it. But as a dumb consumer, it wasn't like Wei Ding Dong that I would only go to for, you know, an anniversary dinner, but it was maybe one small notch below that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
And a great sort of farm to table concept, which is very popular, of course, in California, and a good menu and good service and all that. But there was nothing truly differentiated about it other than it was a nice, good restaurant in a good location. That was my experience as a consumer. But how did you think about it?
I kind of agree in a way, but I think what made it pretty unique is that we had a lot of Scandinavian Swedish influences. And it was really interesting to see that those were for sure the ones that were like standing out and people were like ordering over and over. Like the Swedish meatballs was my mom's recipe. It was our biggest selling appetizer. And then we had a plank stick, which is basically like a filet mignon with on an oak plank that you cook it on the oak plank with like Dutch's potato around the rim and like some vegetables. It's pretty awesome. That's actually
You're
the one thing that I know I miss this dish so much. It's like, oh.
And then with flights, you pulled a classic, what I would call niche down, which is to say, you have created a whole new niche of restaurant, and my interpretation of it, you'll tell me if I'm thinking about it the right way, is I had this aha when Christine told me about you, and then when I started to do a little reading, that on one hand, there's some people who love this concept of tapas, that this notion that maybe four of us are going to go out, you know, two couples are going to go out to dinner and we're going to share, right? And in a good restaurant, there's often many things on the, like I've been to restaurants, you know, really nice restaurants where there's so many good things where you end up ordering a bunch of appetizers and maybe two entrees and everybody share. And so that's a fun thing to do, that family style. And then the other dot that it seems like you connected, and again, I want to hear it from you, is that this notion that you have at sort of high-end restaurants where you can do this pairing of food and wine or food and beer or food and cocktails or all of the above. And as somebody who loves great food but doesn't really know much about it, when you go to a great restaurant and you say, ah, fuck it, I'm not going to order off the menu. I'm going to do the tasting and pairing menu, and I'm going to trust the chef and the sommelier because I just know, you know, like when you sort of say, how do you want your salmon, sir? I'm like, I want the salmon the way the chef wants to do the salmon. Like, don't tell Picasso where to paint the boob. And so I've always loved this notion of signing up for the pairing. And so it seems like you connected this idea of people's love of family style sharing, tapas, however you want to call that, with, hey, man, when a great chef and a great sommelier or a great what the fuck's the word? It's not cocktailologist, mixologist knows something about like pairing, actually the right Chardonnay with the right fish or the right, you know, Chianti with the right meat. Like that's actually, there's a thing going on there as a consumer that I can appreciate. And so tell me about how you got to this revolutionary new niche, if you will, in restaurants.
So I guess I noticed a lot, a big change actually with Holtz. Basically from the first couple of years when we first opened Holtz, everyone was kind of doing the traditional, my salad, my meatballs, and then my entree and my dessert. And then about 2 years into running Holtz, I started seeing every single table. Oh, we'll have this, but bring it for the table. We're all going to share. And literally every single table, like even like what I call the old people that are very set in their ways. And they're like so confused when there's something that's like not the ordinary. Even they started doing it. I was like, people are really changing the way they are experiencing food. And I call it experience for the simple reason that I think that is where something happened. Like, I don't know if it's the cooking shows, like Bobby Flay and all these things like on TV, if that's what kind of, you know, got the piqued the interest, if you will. But if you think about it, like local wines, craft cocktails, fancy plating, fancy dishes, like exploring food and educating yourself over food kind of became a thing. And my theory is the old entertainment that people were getting, basically the interaction with other people, used to happen at the theaters, at the shows, at the dances, at the concerts. And then these days, that's not really how it is. These days, people turn on Netflix for their entertainment, if you will, and all their socializing, entertaining happening in bars and restaurants. And the old nightclub scene, I don't know if it's just me getting older, but I think that like what I'm hearing is that the nightclubs are not doing as well, except for in Vegas, I guess, as they used to. And more people are in restaurants entertaining, like socializing. The hours are getting later in the restaurants. Like it used to be like you're in the restaurants from like 6 to 9, and then from 9 to midnight, you're in like a drinking place and then you go to a club. But now it's kind of like the restaurant is where everyone stays and hangs out, and the restaurants are open till 11, 12 and drink and eat. And it's more about that kind of nibbling, and like, you don't really want to get stuffed. You want to eat healthy. You want to have a lot of flavors. You want to share with your friends, and you want to take pictures of it and put it on Instagram and tell all your internet friends that, look at my fancy experience I had today. And this is so cool and Instagram worthy and this kind of thing. And that's just my theory about it. So that's kind of all played into the creation of Flights, where we're not trying to be like high end. We're not trying to be super fancy. We're trying to serve really simple, tasty food, but in a fun way where you can interact and have fun and not, you know, spend a fortune doing that.
It's such a great insight. And it also, it seems to me you've tapped into, you know, I think for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. And we live in an ADHD world of, you know, all these, you know, tweets and Kardashian ass selfies and clickbait and all this bullshit. And we're all addicted to our phones and bing, bing, bing going off all the time. And so on one hand, nobody pays any attention to anything anymore. And we're not really with each other. But it, the flip side of that is the sort of main time we have in our day to put all that shit down and do what you and I are doing today, which is, you know, look each other in the face and actually pay attention to each other and get engaged in, you know, a real no bullshit conversation. And so people now are craving that, right? I think it's a big part of the success of podcasting. And no, I'm not surprised to hear it's a big part of your success.
Yeah, I definitely think that people for a long time, as kind of Facebook took over, Instagram became big and Snap and all this other stuff, like people were really getting offline, like, sorry, they were getting online, but basically getting their personal interactions offline. And I think it's kind of trending back again. So now people are connected with their phones and interacting, but they're also, you know, really kind of wanting that back of like that personal human interaction.
The other thing it seems like you've taken advantage of is there's been a clear rise in, you tell me, I don't have the lingo and stuff, but like mixologists and like bartenders are like in a place of kind of an exalted position today in a way that maybe they weren't, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago. Is that true?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I mean, think about it. Like, every single person would order like a vodka martini or a Jack and Coke or gin and tonic, like even like 10 years ago. And then, you know, somewhere, like something happened where basically people are starting to explore and test and, you know, bend the boundaries. And now there's like smoke infused cocktails. There is like crazy ice cubes with flavors. There, I mean, there's just so many new things and all these like fresh ingredients and, you know, crazy things going on. It's like real, you know, almost chemistry labbing going on where they're
chemical,
like
chemical innovation.
Yeah.
And so, has the mixologist sort of become the new ding dong sommelier in some ways?
I think so. I think so for sure. It's definitely a hype around it. And what we did with flights actually, because like the whole concept was in my head was kind of based around like that Pan Am era where like the flight attendants had like all that power and glory and it was like so cool. And so we wanted to kind of bring the classics back in our cocktail program too. So what we did is we basically have all the classic drinks, like the old fashioned, the Manhattans, the martinis, the cosmopolitans, margaritas, but we're using craft cocktail ingredients and techniques to make it happen. Like for example, biggest seller is the margarita. So every morning we press fresh juices. We use like all these, like we make our own simple syrup. We make our own ingredients and then we mix it all into this. It looks like a beer keg almost. And it's basically what they call a cocktail keg. And then we put it on one of our drafts, just like you would like a tap beer. And then basically, you know, for speed, when you have to serve three of the different drinks, you have a product that's delicious, consistent, and super fast. And, the guest loves it.
Well, and I love that you're doing that because I love margaritas. I love tequila. And I'm very careful about where I order them because there's nothing better than a great margarita and there's nothing worse than a shit margarita. You know, like
I agree with that.
And fuck it, I'll just throw them under the bus. Like if you go to a place like a Chili's or, you know, one of those horrible mass chains and you order a margarita, like the mix they use, you can just feel, you know, you can feel the cancer starting as it rolls down your throat and it's just all gross and it's too sweet and it's just disgusting. And it's like, and of course they put the shittiest tequila they can in it and all of that. Right. And so that's at one extreme. And then at the other extreme is the kind of thing that you're doing. And when you have, you know, a real margarita made by somebody who knows what they're doing, who actually gives a shit about the drink, it's like, oh my God, this thing's incredible.
Yeah, no, I agree with that for sure. And I think what it comes down to is it's actually very simple. It's real ingredients versus like not real ingredients, I guess.
Yeah.
That's where you get the real flavors. Like I remember we were doing some tastings of fruit where basically we were testing like, you know, like locally grown, like high quality, like fresh peaches and we basically pretended that it was like some fancy dessert with this one table. I remember when it was Holtz and because I really like I had a bite of this peach at the farmer's market in Los Gatos. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like the best peach I've had. So I bought some and then all I did I cut it into like perfectly symmetrical cubes and then I sprinkled a little sugar on top of it and I, you know, plated it really fancy on like a big plate and just like a couple of peaches bites. And I served it to a guest, kind of as a complimentary dessert. And they took a bite and they're like, oh my God, this is delicious. How did you make this? What is this? What techniques did you use to get this? And like, I was like trying to keep my face. And I was like, yeah, we're talking about putting this on the menu. And because this is someone I actually knew pretty well. So I was giving him some shit. What kind of price point do you think? And he was like, oh, I'm thinking like, you know, $11-$12. And I'm talking like three, like bites this big, like little sugar cube sized bites. And he was like $11-$12. And how did you make this? And like, how much time does it take? And And I was, and then I finally couldn't keep it together. And I told him this was cut up peaches. And he's like, no, I don't believe it. It's like, that's all it was. It was locally grown peaches. But that kind of goes back to that, you know, like using like a, you know, like some syrup that's been sitting on a, in a warehouse for 6 months with artificial ingredients versus like pressing a fresh lime. Obviously you're going to have a different result.
Yeah. And I'm just curious to ask because my taste in wine and my taste in beer has changed pretty meaningfully over the last decade or so. And I remember when I was a young guy coming up, you know, as a marketer, even though I wasn't in the B2B or food space, a B2C space or food space. But I remember hearing things like, oh, you know, the reason Budweiser does the marketing they do, they're targeting it at 18-year-old, you know, primarily guys because, you know, if they can get you at 18, then you're going to be a Budweiser man your whole life. And, you know, that has not been my experience, and that has not been the experience of a lot of people that I know in terms of beer or wine or cocktails. To your point, people are being a lot more experimental and a lot more adventurous and so forth. And so the other question I have for you in this regard is how important has craft beer been to what you guys are doing?
So it's interesting you bring that up because, like, I love trying like craft beers and like local brewery, like mostly for the reason of like supporting the locals and like, cause I know how hard it is to open a small business. But for our particular model, it's meant to be streamlined so that we can open a lot of these like all over the United States. So we had to kind of limit ourselves to one distributor and then basically one that would be available all across the United States. So we basically went to town and tried all the beers basically that they had and then pick the best three pilsners and the best, you know, three IPAs and dark beers and wheat beers. And what we found surprisingly a little bit is that we really thought that like for example, on the pilsner, like we tasted all these pilsners, probably like 50 of them and it was a lot of us. It was like 12, 15 of us that made those decisions. And the one that almost every single person had on their top three was Corona. So there's a reason why they are so big. And there's a reason why people, you know, like it. It's because it's really good. And also what we had to kind of keep in mind was we wanted to show different styles of, so for example, our Pinot Noir flight. We didn't like necessarily pick the three best Pinot Noirs. We wanted to showcase the three different categories or like very different categories of Pinot Noirs where basically one's from Italy, one's from Spain, France, Italy, and California. So that basically you can taste like the sweetness in the fruit when you're in California, you can taste the dryness and like the stuff from France, and then you have a little bit of a mix in Italy. And that's kind of cool, and I think a little bit of educational. And I also think that plays in a lot these days. So that's how we built a lot of these flights where we picked beers from different areas, and one can be like super well-known and kind of like what everyone drinks, like the Corona, for example. And then another pilsner we have is Trumer, which is out of Berkeley, which is very like local and smaller, craftier. But I think it's very interesting to kind of compare the two and educate yourself. So on each flight, there's like a little card that kind of explains where it's from, how it's made, the flavors, and kind of how they compare to each other. And I think that educational piece is pretty cool.
I think that's very cool. I think I didn't realize you did that. I think we're living at a time where more and more people want to understand the background of what they're eating and where it was sourced. And, you know, I remember one of the first times I went and toured Napa Valley long before I lived here. And, you know, the guy giving the tour, the winery, called himself a cork dork, and he's talking about all this shit. And yeah, I don't remember most of that shit. But, you know, when you're there, here, like, food bullshit and booze bullshit is really good bullshit, right? As a customer, it's sort of fun to hear about all that stuff and why, you know, there's this taste in this beer or cocktail or wine and why that goes well with this food. And that's, I don't know, that's a fun conversation to be part of in an evening.
Yeah, no, very much so. I 100% agree. And like back to what we were talking about, but by socializing in restaurants, it kind of drives the topic of conversation. Like by serving the food. So like, okay, so look at this, like, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you're at a normal three-course dinner, like how everyone was eating. And this is the end of the conversation. How was your meat? Oh yeah, yeah, mine was good too. And that's about it, right? Like now, if you're serving the food in the middle and like you take a bite of this and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so spicy. Like, try this. You like spicy, right? And then they're like, oh, this mac and cheese is delicious. Like, it's so creamy. But like, compare it to what the one with truffle here. And yeah, so it just like creates like a nonstop conversation that just goes on and throughout the experience. Like, and people are sharing and trying and educating themselves doing it. It's this pretty cool way of eating.
And so, when did you, so when you were back at Holtz and you saw people doing this sort of family style eating and you had that aha, how did you sort of get the next aha to connect to it, which is, hey, what if we do this share family style tapas move and we pair it with alcohol, whether it's wine or beer or cocktails or all of the above? How did you connect that sort of pairing with the sharing, so to speak?
Well, so all of this kind of happened all at the same time. But basically, when we were on our honeymoon, a year and a half after we got engaged, we went to the swim up bar at the resort we were staying. And they served us in literally those like school plastic cups, like the cheapest kind. They served us three different frozen drinks. And we're like, oh my God, this is so tasty. Like to have, instead of having like one big drink of the same flavor, to have three different flavors. Like one was a strawberry daiquiri, one was a Mai Tai, and one was a pina colada, which is actually on our menu right now as the number one drink. And it's called a tropical flight. But basically, that's how it all started.
How big are these? I got to interrupt you. How big are these glasses, these cocktails come in?
That we serve?
Yeah.
So each of our flights is built to be exactly two regular size cocktails so that people can still drive and be safe. So basically, like a normal glass of wine is 6 ounces. Each of our wines are 4, 4, and 4. So you get 12 ounces of wine.
Guy like me when I come to flights. I really need to take my lift there because I'm probably not going to limit myself to one flight because this just sounds way too good not to do lots of.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens. It gets like a little bit of a party scene and that's kind of the atmosphere that people are craving and what they want. So I think that definitely works pretty well for us. But what I wanted to say about the, you know, basically how the concept came about is when we had that drink, we both were like, oh, that would be so cool to do like a bar where everything comes in like a flight, like even cocktails. Because everyone have had like beer flights and wine flights, but no one that I've seen had really done cocktail flights until this like little cheap swim up bar that was serving it out of plastic glasses. And I just like started seeing these like visions in my head of what we could make out of it. And then we didn't really do too much about it because we were all like in love and on our honeymoon. And about a month after we got home, we went to another restaurant in Los Gatos where they have really good margaritas. And we asked if we could do a sampler. And they're like, no, we don't really do that. And I was like, oh, okay. So we just ended up ordering three full-size margaritas. And we were looking at each other, kind of sitting there at the table. Like one was purple, one was red, one was green. Something like that. It was like a kiwi and a watermelon. I don't even remember the flavors. And we were like, wow, this looks so pretty. There was sun and it was just a beautiful moment. So yeah, basically another couple of months goes by and then 4 a.m. I wake up and I have this like vision in my head. And I go downstairs and I start typing and I keep typing. And like 10 hours later, my wife's like, you need to eat something. And I was like, oh, I'm almost done. I'm almost done. I'm almost done. And basically, I write this whole business plan about this whole thing and how things were going to look and all these different things. And then when we were in Campbell actually putting this all together, we started adding a little bit of that aviation theme into it. So in the original business plan, the whole like flight attendant uniforms and the frequent flights rewards program and checking in for first class upgrade, all that stuff kind of happened as we were putting the restaurant together. And like, I was like, oh, that would be really cool. Oh, that would be really cool to kind of really complete the whole concept. And like, we have some flight, like aviation memorabilia and cool pictures and airplanes from the 60s, 70s and 80s, like kind of in frames. And in the Burlingame location, we actually hung an actual aircraft in the ceiling. So that's pretty, pretty cool. It's a 32 wow. feet. Yeah, it's enormous. It's like a big airplane. And
how did you get it in the building?
In 15 pieces. It was quite a scene. So it was, for some reason, the whole delivery got delayed. It was supposed to come on a Tuesday, but ended up coming on a Friday. So imagine Burlingame Avenue on a Friday night. I mean, the streets were packed. The restaurants around us were packed and the people everywhere. And all of a sudden we're out there like blocking traffic to like take in this like enormous aircraft into the restaurant and to start mounting into the ceiling. It was quite a scene.
I love it. So fun. And what I love about what you've done is, you know, some people come up with a concept, you know, what I would call a niche down. You know, you're designing a new category of restaurant. And you went all in. Like, some of this stuff, and I say this with massive love and respect, is a little corny, right?
Oh,
it's a little
totally
silly,
is.
Right?
It's 100% is. I mean, when our flight attendants come to the table, they're like, have you flown with us before? And people are like, no, we haven't. First time. It's like, okay, let me go over some flight, some safety instructions, basically. And then people start laughing again. And then, are you going to tell us to fasten the seatbelts too? And people, you know, people just like get a kick out of it. But it's like, it's all a part of that. Like, some people think it's cheesy. Some people think it's like, you know, fun. But pretty much every single table at least gets some kind of an interaction out of it where, like, it gets them talking. It gets them either to talk shit or to praise it. So either way, it disturbs the normal status quo, and I like that.
Yeah. I'm also curious, what's the reaction of your staff? Like, if I've been a waiter or a waitress at some other kind of restaurants and I've had some experience and now I come work for you at Flights, how's it different for them, you know, doing the shtick as opposed to just being at a generic restaurant?
It's definitely a little different. It takes them a little time to get used to, but I think what they see and what they learned is that if they own it and go all in and like really make fun of it, are we experiencing any turbulence here, guys? Like really like kind of like be cheesy, then people buy it. But if they're like kind of half-assing it and like coming in like with a little lame line here and there, then people are like, what are you doing? Like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
So
do they end up having more fun with your guests than a typical waiter or waitress would have at a typical restaurant?
I definitely would say so.
Yeah. And I got to believe the bartender behind the bar making the drinks, or if I'm sitting at the bar, and it's got, you know, that's just got to be a little bit more fun than a generic bar, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a scene. The bar is pretty much always full, and they are kind of like, you know, the rock stars performing almost.
Yeah.
Because all of our drinks look so pretty, and it's three of them, and like all these garnishes and fresh fruits and all this stuff. Like, it takes it's a little bit of an art to put it together, and then people are like watching them and they're like interacting and making jokes and that kind of thing. Yeah, it's definitely fun.
Now, the other thing I'm curious about, as you're developing this idea, Alex, you know, it's a big idea, it's a hugely differentiated idea, never been done before. I sort of have two questions. One is, did you have trepidation around, shit, is this going to work? Like, this is so fucking different than what's come before. Like, is this thing going to work? Did you have moments where you were, you know, didn't know? Or did you always feel in your gut, this crazy different idea, this thing's going to go?
Honestly, you never know, but I kind of knew that it was going to be a very successful thing because it just felt right. I was like, whenever you can serve three of something to someone and everyone can share and interact, like, I just thought it was like so ahead of its time and really solving a lot of those little mysteries and what people are looking for, basically. So I really felt like early on before we even opened the first restaurant that it was going to be very successful. And there is some proof in that because I built the whole concept knowing we were going to grow to a big company and open multiple, like a lot of locations throughout the US and ultimately franchise and all this stuff. So yeah, I was pretty optimistic. And then when we opened Campbell right away, like the first night, I think we had 1300 people come through and that's just insane.
Yeah. Cause it's not that big of a restaurant, is it?
No, it is not. 49 seats.
Yeah. It's not exactly the Cheesecake Factory.
No.
And I got to ask you, was the name obvious to you from the beginning or how did you come up with the name?
We were kind of toying with the name Flights and Bites for a while. So the original menu was going to be a little bit more advanced than what we decided on. Basically it was going to be like flights and bites from around the world. That was like kind of our slogan. And the menu was supposed to be a map, a world map, and then basically like an arrow to the region where the food was from. And it had, you know, all these weird foods like Amsterdam. They have their little fried potatoes that like no one really knows how to pronounce, but it's delicious. And then down in South America, you have your patatas bravas. And then there's all these like weird foods throughout the world that like taste really good, but a lot of people don't know about. So that's kind of what was the original plan. But then when we started looking at the menu, we're like, wow, this menu is all over the place. And we were like, okay, we need
to scale
this. It
looks like maybe we had consumed some cocktail flights before we created this menu.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe like eaten some mushrooms or something. It was pretty, pretty crazy. So we basically scaled it back and we're like, okay, what does people eat every day? What do they want? And then how do we make it look pretty and how do we make it in three different variations of the same dish?
And is that when you decided to sort of focus on less maybe exotic or and more? I mean, the thing that I find fascinating is you focused in on, and I think you use these words, tell me if I'm getting it wrong, but more comfort food.
Oh, 100%. That's what we call the category of restaurant. It's a comfort food tapas restaurant, which is, in my opinion, a new category that hasn't been done before.
Look, I'm no expert on the restaurant business, but you are an intuitive category designer. You created a whole new category of restaurant. And the thing I love about it is most entrepreneurs think it's about branding. Well, it's not. It's actually about what's the niche, what's the category. You lock and load that, what maybe you would also maybe call the concept. Mm-hmm. And then you tied your brand to your category. You know, so when Christine is first telling me about your restaurant, she can deliver what in our vernacular around here we call the point of view on her own, right? Because the name begins the story, right? And then she fulfills the story and I immediately get the concept and I'm like, oh my God, we got to go there. And so it was sort of what I'm saying to you is your ability to design the new category and then design the brand and name to connect the two of them so that there's a natural story that comes out from a customer. The customer can parrot your vision in less than a minute.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, people use the slogan like a picture is more than 1,000 words. That's where I really think we're capturing our audience, because people, a very, very high percentage of people that come to Flights, take a picture of their food or their drink and put it on Instagram and social media. And pretty much right away, when you see like two of our drink flights take a picture without saying a single thing, and they just see the load, like checked in at Flights, they get the concept, because it's like, okay, a flight of, oh, drinks, got it. Okay, cool. And even our logo is three cocktail glasses with wings. So like the aviation meets the three drinks. Which I actually got patented yesterday. I got the mail from the, cause it's really hard in the food industry to get a patent on anything. Because pretty much everything has been done. And like, that was one of the reasons why we went away from the Flights and Bites, because a lot of people had used that not as a restaurant name, but to market their like happy hour or their like, you know, little you know, special event or something like that, where basically they called it Flights and Bites. So we couldn't quite take that on as our name and restaurant.
Well, and Flights is nice and tight.
Yeah, it's simple, very simple.
Yeah. And so you sort of hinted at it a little bit, Alex, but I'd love it if you unpacked it for me. What's the ultimate vision for Flights?
Well, it's actually really interesting because the original business plan spelled it out very much like the growth that we've had to open 3-4 local locations. And we're opening our fourth one here soon. And then next year, we're planning on going.
Alex, I hate to interrupt you, but when did you open the first Flights?
A year ago.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So you're a year in and you're getting ready to open number 4.
Yeah, it's been very, very fast.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to underscore that. And so yeah, keep going. Where do we see this over time from that original night that you spent writing like a madman today?
Yeah, so basically Vegas was going to be our first like big showroom where like if people were interested in a franchise, they would fly into Vegas, they would see our major store in action, and they would do their training there. And then, you know, ultimately we would fly out and help them find a good location in that area where they would be, and then help them successfully open a new location as a franchise. So that is basically my goal for next year, is to get the restaurant in Los Gatos up and running and then start finding the first couple franchisees.
Wow, how exciting. And I also must ask you, how are you thinking about, you know, how have you been and how do you think about going forward financing the business?
I've been pretty fortunate. Pretty much right away when we opened, I got involved with a couple of the Sharks players. You know, being drafted by the Sharks, I have a little bit of connection there, know a couple of the guys. And couple of the big names, like one of the bigger stars is one of my investors. So you kind of right away get that credibility. It's like, oh yeah, it's Alex who's done this before. And then he also has the celebrity sports star behind it. And then I was also able to get 3 top CEO president type of people for really big companies here in the Valley, you know, billionaire type of big guys. So with that group of people, we can ultimately grow as much as we want and as fast as we can. But we're in a pretty good situation. If we keep doing well, I don't think the finance is going to be a problem. I think it's more like growing in the right direction and the right pace, where you don't step on any of those landmines that kind of take a leg off and slow your growth down, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've had this happen. I live in Santa Cruz, and we've had this happen with a couple of local restaurants where a new restaurant will open. You know, there's always that first couple week period where it's always a little wonky or weird. But after they get through that, they lock and load, and then you sort of fall in love with the restaurant. It's like, wow, it's really great, and so forth and so on. And then, I don't know, maybe about a year in, you know, they haven't changed the menu up very much, and maybe they get a little turnover, and then, you know, all of a sudden it sort of starts to suck, and you're like, ah, I'm kind of sick of this place now. It's not, you know, their attention to detail slides, and there's one in particular I'm thinking of, and I don't want to throw them under the bus, but, you know, there was a 2-year period after probably a year and a half period where I sort of ate there once every other week kind of a thing, and then there was a 2-year period where I was like, fuck it. You know, like, for example, I can't stand pickles. I don't know if I was abused with one as a child. I have no idea, but like, I can't be in the same zip code as a pickle. And I love a good burger, and this place had a good burger. And, you know, they would keep bringing me the fucking pickle, even though I'd say to them, don't bring the pickle. Anyway, so when they brought the pickle for the last time, I was like, that's it. And I didn't go back for 2 years. And then we heard from some friends that, you know, it was sort of had come back, and, you know, now we're back to being regulars. And so there's clearly these troughs, and I don't know shit about this business, but there's clearly these troughs restaurants can go through. And you know, particularly as a new restaurant, when people have the enthusiasm that they have around what you're doing, you don't want to hit that trough where people get sick of it because maybe the menu isn't changing enough, or the staff, you know, second wave of staff isn't as good, or you know, if you're not there as the owner, is the attention to detail the way you want? And so how do you think about maintaining that high level of quality so that you keep us coming back?
You know, that's actually the hardest part, to keep having like attention to detail and keep, it's all about your employees. Like, you're never better than your worst employee, because, you know, you feel like you're doing, you know, the same thing, but if you're not paying attention, it's very easy to kind of veer off and lose track of what you're doing. And I think that is, like for every single restaurant, doesn't matter if it's a McDonald's, if it's a Chili's, or if it's a high-end Manresa, you're trying to do a good product every day, but it's so easy to have that one employee that just like had a bad day, brings it into work, gives a bad service, and then that one chef that had a fight with this girl and his head is not in the game. And like, you're never better than your worst employee. And I really believe in like trying to bring that worst employee up and make them better and constantly try to improve. We're constantly changing. We're every day, I feel like I'm thinking about something that we can do to make it the concept better, to make the menu better. The only thing that makes it very different when you have, you know, four locations versus when you just had Holtz is that now it's not just as simple as printing a new menu and you're done and you tell your three servers, hey, we're doing it this way now. Now you have, you know, all these online stuff you have to update, you have to print, like order brand new menus, you have to deliver them to all four different locations, you have to have four different staff meetings to train the new staff on the changes. So basically, you've got to go about it in a little bit of a different way where you have to have your day-to-day managers kind of keep the quality and the consistency up and making sure that things are being followed. And then on the changes, you have to kind of schedule it out so that, like, okay, for the month of, for this summer month, we're going to have Patlin Winery from Napa as a special flight. And, you know, 2 months before it actually happens, you get the wine in-house, you print the cards, you put it in the system, and you train the staff on the staff meeting that's already scheduled, so you don't have to have two staff meetings because that costs money, that kind of thing. So just, you have to be more systematic and more organized in everything you do when you have multiple locations, because it's not as easy as it used to be to make changes.
Yep. That makes a ton of sense. All right, Alex, I know you've got a lot to do to go build this category and continue to become one of the great restaurateurs in the excited states. So I don't I want to keep you for too much longer. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap?
No, I think we had a fun conversation. It was very nice to chat with you and meet with you. And I'm excited to you know, have people listen to this and hopefully come into flights and see what we do.
Well, fantastic. And Carrie and I will be there soon.
All right.
Yeah, I guess my last question for you is, hey, what about Santa Cruz?
Yeah, we actually, you know, we were thinking about some places like Santa Cruz, Morgan Hill, and Walnut Creek. But ultimately what we want to do is we want to kind of build the next flagship in Vegas and then have other people open those locations. So, you know, you have that, you know, guy in Santa Cruz that have done some restaurant business before, and he's like, wow, this concept is really good. And then he gets the, you know, we help him get set up, and all of a sudden now there's a flights there, that kind of a thing.
So hopefully an entrepreneur in Santa Cruz will get excited and we'll have a flights here soon.
I would love that too.
All right, Alex. I love what you're doing. It's a real inspiration. I got to say, you're a great example of, you know, there's this dumbass advice you hear for entrepreneurs all the time, follow your passion, right? Well, you know, your passion was hockey. And then that didn't turn out. And then your passion was poker. And it sounds like you had some success, but, you know, your wife didn't want you sitting home in your underwear, right? And so I just love your story because I think it's the reality for many of us that we thrash around, we fail, we have some success. You know, your first restaurant was a success, but it wasn't a smash success like Flights now, right? And so I just love how open and honest you are about, tried this in my life, tried that in my life, went here, went there. And then all of a sudden, I figured some big shit out and bam.
Yeah, well, I think being a professional athlete and being very motivated and driven at a young age kind of bring, like, I don't think it mattered if I would have been in the restaurant business or any other business. I just don't stop. I just keep going. I push myself. I work hard. I work more than anyone I know. And you know, success doesn't just, a lot of times at least, doesn't just get handed to you. You just have to earn it and work and continue to work and work and work and work until something starts to happen. And then you see the light in the tunnel and you work even harder. And then, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, like you start to see some progress.
Yeah. Well, your story is a very impressive story. It's the classic American entrepreneurship story that I certainly love. You are a classic example of a niche down. And if it's okay with you, what I'd like to do is schedule a time for Carrie and I to come over, have dinner, bring you a copy of my book, and maybe enjoy a flight of those margaritas with you.
Yeah, that'd be great. The mango jalapeno one is my favorite drink. So
awesome. I can't wait. Thank you so much, Alex. We'll talk soon, brother.
All right. Sounds good. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that's a great one, isn't it? I hope you loved that conversation as much as I did. What an inspiring man and fun set of insights and conversations. If you know somebody who would love this episode, I'd love it if you shared it with them. The number one thing you can do if you want to help us at all, and maybe you don't give a shit, which is fine. Hey, I'm just glad you're listening. But if you want to help, the number one thing you can do is share Legends and Losers. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or most any other podcast platform, there's a share button right there. And you can tweet this episode, you can post it on social media, or you can email it directly to a friend. Any and all of those things make a giant difference. And from the bottom of my heart, I would deeply appreciate it. Now, is it time for you to turbocharge your growth? We're at the lowest level of entrepreneurship in America, and it is time for our entrepreneurial companies to be more successful than ever. And as you know, if you're a longtime listener, I care deeply about our entrepreneurs, and so does our founding sponsor, NetSuite. They are on the same mission that I am on, which is to empower entrepreneurship and to support entrepreneurs. Look, it's not a mistake that they're our first sponsor. We didn't want a left-handed nose trimmer as our sponsor. NetSuite helps you level the playing field by providing enterprise class, world class technologies and applications for running every part of your business. They're the leader in what you could think of as cloud ERP, and they're really a full business management system, allowing small entrepreneurs and startups to beat the snot out of the big guys. They offer growing businesses a cloud platform that gives you real-time visibility into all parts of your business. So for example, if you sell out of your warehouse, your website knows that, and your team is automatically alerted to order more inventory. You have real-time integrated invoicing that keeps you up to date on who's paying, who's not paying, so that you can be on top of your accounts receivable and ultimately cash flow. And NetSuite allows you to run your business from your smartphone with a set of awesome dashboards and alerts right there on your phone. Now, NetSuite is offering our listeners an unbelievable deal. Go to netsuite.com/legends, and there you can book a free one-hour growth review with an expert in your industry on how you can turbocharge your growth, dealing with barriers to growth, overcoming those barriers, and moving your business to the cloud. So check out netsuite.com/legends today. All right. We would like to thank Flights, the incredible new restaurant. This is the awesome new way to share and taste food. You can make a reservation. You can check them out at flightsrestaurants.com. HarperCollins Instant Classic Play Bigger, how pirates, dreamers, and innovators create and dominate markets. The holiday season's coming up. Maybe that's a good one. Equity Directory, connecting startups to the talent and resources they need to build a legendary business. The amazing folks at onelifefullylived.org. This is the nonprofit helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. And if by chance you're somebody looking for a nonprofit to support, we would love your support, onelifefullylived.org. Now, are you in the B2B business? Are you in Silicon Valley? Well, then check out Atre, Atre.net. Atrenet builds B2B websites that sell. Imagine your best spokesperson on your website. That's what Atrenet does. So if you need a new corporate B2B website, Atre.net. Interview Valet. If you're a thought leader and you want to get your leading thoughts on some podcasts, check out interviewvalet.com. And speaking of websites I love, growwire.com. This is the new place for entrepreneurs who want to check out the latest innovations, who want to learn how to grow themselves, their careers, and their business. Heather Clancy and I have been blogging for them. Eddie Yoon's got some stuff up there, and lots of super smart people. Check out growwire.com. And of course, with the holidays coming up, why not pick up a couple thousand copies of the number one bestseller by Heather Clancy and myself, Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. Check it out today on Amazon.com and the World Wildlife Foundation, because our planet and wildlife matter. Check out WWF.org. All right, now I need to remind you that this oddcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Oddcast Network, and we would love it if you shared the shit out of it. All rights do remain disturbed. We must warn you that every episode does contain nuts, clearly. And the producers and creators of this podcast may have been consuming libations. Beware of pre-I in the passing lane. In the case of business bullshit, take two legends and losers and tweet us in the morning. Introduce two people you love to two podcasts you love. Remember, it's hard for new people to get into podcasts, so help them get set up on their smartphone or their tablet or whatever else. Remember, fire is not supposed to be a season. Wow, we've got fire season raging in California right now, and does it ever suck? Listen to the Tragically Hip. Don't forget that Joan Jett was right. And today, our deepest apologies go out to American Airlines CEO Doug Parker. Sorry, Dougie, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing part of your life with me. I can't thank you enough for being part of Legends and Losers, and look forward to seeing you again soon.